The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for this episode of Into the Killing. If you have a cold case that was solved that you want to suggest for Into the Killing, please visit our website, criminallylisted.com, then go to the Suggest a Case page. You can also suggest cases for our two YouTube channels, Criminally Listed and Paranormally Listed. For this episode, we're going back to October 1971. Walt Disney World opened its doors for the first time on October 1st, 1971, just outside Orlando, Florida. It was the second Disney theme park. Disneyland in Anaheim, California opened in 1955. Walt Disney was looking to open a second location east of the Mississippi River. Only about 5% of Disneyland's guests were from the east, but 75% of the American population lived east of the Mississippi River. For the location, Disney settled on Central Florida, just outside of Orlando. In 1964, Disney started buying farmland in secret using dummy corporations. Then, on November 15, 1965, Disney announced he would be opening his new theme park there. Construction began in May 1969. Over 9,000 people worked on its construction. It cost $400 million, which in 2024 is about $3.4 billion. On opening day, the prices were $1 for children under 12, $2.50 for teenagers, and $3.50 for adults. Accounting for inflation, that is $7.77 for children under 12, $19.43 for teenagers, and $27.20 for adults. Celebrities who attended that day included Julie Andrews and Rock Hudson. In the first 2 years of operations, over 20 million people visited Disney World. Over 50 years later, an average of 58 million people visit the theme park annually. Disney had purchased 27,443 acres, but at the time of this recording, only about half of it has been developed. The first arcade video game and commercially available video game, Computer Space, debuted at the Music Operators of America Expo on October 15, 1971. The first computer game, Space War, was developed at MIT in 1962, less than a decade earlier. But the game wasn't publicly available because computers weren't easily accessible in the 1960s. They were mostly found in government buildings and universities. They also didn't have easy-to-use operating systems like Microsoft Windows, so you needed special training to use them. Space War is a space combat game where players duel another spaceship around an orbiting star. In the 1960s, Nolan Bushnell, who has a BS in electrical engineering from the University of Utah, was working at an electronics company in Hayward, California. One day, he told his coworker and friend, Ted Dabney, that he wanted to own family-friendly pizza parlors with amusement park Midway Games. Dabney took Bushnell to Stanford University's Artificial Intelligence Laboratory and let him play Space War. Bushnell saw incredible potential in the video game. In 1969, Bushnell and Dabney launched their own company called Syzygy Engineering. According to Merriam-Webster, Syzygy is, quote, the nearly straight-line configuration of three celestial bodies, such as the Sun, Moon, and Earth, during a solar or lunar eclipse, a gravitational system, unquote. Their goal was to make a game like Space War for commercial use. They teamed with a coin-operated trivia and shooting game manufacturer and created Space War. The first unit, which debuted at the Music Operators of America Expo, was a wooden cabinet. Afterwards, they got a swimming pool manufacturer to create a fiberglass case for the game. Computer Space was a moderate success. Bushnell and Dabney continued to work on video games. In 1972, they changed their company name to Atari Inc. Atari is a Japanese word used in the ancient board game, Go. It roughly means to hit a target. Bushnell said that Go was his favorite game. In November 1972, Atari released Pong, which was incredibly popular. Following the release of Pong in 1973, Ted Dabney left the company. He felt he was being mistreated by Bushnell. Dabney sold his part of the business for $250,000, which is about $1.2 million in 2024. The Atari 2600 home video game console was released in September 1977, starting the home video game console revolution. In 1979, Nolan Bushnell was forced out of Atari. 2 years earlier, in 1977, Bushnell opened the pizza parlor he had initially dreamed of a decade earlier. The first Chuck E. Cheese Pizza Time Theater was opened in San Jose, California in May 1971. Bushnell went on to open dozens of restaurants in 16 states. Then in 1983, there was the video game recession. The market had become oversaturated with terrible games, and people had become more interested in personal computers. Chuck E. Cheese started losing millions of dollars. In 1984, Bushnell declared bankruptcy. Chuck E. Cheese was purchased and continues to operate with 561 restaurants in the United States, Canada, and Mexico. In 1992, Atari merged with their parent company, Warner Communications, which is now Time Warner. On October 13, 1971, a World Series game was played at night for the first time. The first modern World Series was played in 1903. Although the first night game had been played in 1935, all the World Series games in the previous 67 years were played during the afternoon. In the 1971 World Series, the Pittsburgh Pirates were playing the Baltimore Orioles. The first three games in the series were played at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Game 4 at Three Rivers Stadium in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which opened a year earlier, started at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and was broadcast on NBC. The Pirates won the game 4-3 and went on to win the series in 7 games. It was the Pittsburgh Pirates' fourth World Series title. The Pirates' right fielder veteran, Roberto Clemente, was named the World Series' most valuable player. He was the first Spanish-speaking player to win the World Series MVP. After that first night game, World Series games were played more regularly at night, and eventually, all of them were played in the evening. The last afternoon World Series game was Game 6 of the 1987 World Series. On October 3, 1971, the number one song was Maggie May by Rod Stewart. The number one movie was Koch, which was the only film directed by legendary actor Jack Lemmon. It starred his friend and frequent co-star Walter Matthau. In October 1971, 30-year-old Malin Johnson lived in Newark, New Jersey. She had three children, two sons, George and David, and a daughter, Susan. Early on the morning of October 3, 1971, 14-year-old Susan called the police. The police arrived, and they found the dead body of Malin on her bed. She was dressed in her nightgown, and she had been shot once in the chest. The murder weapon was found in a dresser drawer. Susan said that she woke up and heard tires squealing. She looked out the window and saw her mother's boyfriend's car driving away. She went into her mother's room and found her dead. Her brothers, who were 10 and 8, were asleep in their beds. The police's immediate suspect was the boyfriend. However, the police couldn't find any evidence that connected him to the murder. In the early 1970s, Newark, which had a population of about 380,000 people, was a violent place. Statistically, a murder was committed there every other day. In 1971, Malin's murder was mentioned once in the local newspaper. The article also addressed two other murders that happened on the same day. 59-year-old William Love was shot 4 times at a bar. 38-year-old Charles Monroe was stabbed to death in a housing project. So it wasn't long before Malin's murder went cold. If the murders of William Love and Charles Monroe were solved, we could not find any record of that. Like Malin's murder, their murders were never talked about again in the newspapers. Twenty-seven years passed, and no progress was made in Malin Johnson's case. But in 1998, all that changed. Popular movies released in 1971 were Harold and Maude, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and A Clockwork Orange. In 1998, Deep Impact, The Big Lebowski, and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas all bowed in the theaters. Classic albums released in 1971 include John Lennon's Imagine, Bill Withers' Just As I Am, and Joni Mitchell's Blue. 1998 saw the release of The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill by Lauryn Hill, The Shape of Punk to Come by Refused, and Wide Open Spaces by The Dixie Chicks. Shows that debuted in 1971 were Soul Train, The Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour, and Upstairs Downstairs. TV shows that debuted in 1998 were Sex and the City, Dawson's Creek, and Celebrity Deathmatch. Popular books published in 1971 include The Exorcist by William Peter Blatty, Stone Soup by Anne McGovern, and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas by Hunter S. Thompson. Fear and Loathing was originally published in two parts in Rolling Stone magazine. It's the basis for the 1998 movie Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Hunter S. Thompson also published a book in 1998, The Rum Diaries. Thompson started working on the book in 1959 when he was 22. He finished it in the 1960s, but didn't get it published. Johnny Depp, who plays Thompson's alter ego, Raoul Duke, in Fear and Loathing, found the unpublished manuscript while looking through Thompson's papers. This led to the publication of The Rum Diary. Depp played the lead in the 2011 movie adaptation of The Rum Diary. It took 11 years to get the film made. Hunter S. Thompson never saw the film come to fruition. He fatally shot himself in February 2005 at age 67. On the set of The Rum Diary, Depp met the woman he would go on to marry, Amber Heard. Michael Cunningham's The Hours and A Better Boy by Nick Hornby were also published in 1998. In the autumn of 1998, the Newark Police Department created a cold case unit consisting of two detectives, Rashid Saber and Keith Shepard. In October 1998, they received a call from Malin's sons, George and David Johnson. They wanted the detectives to reopen their mother's case. They also provided the detectives with a new lead. They thought she was in a relationship with another man and he may have killed her. Detectives Saber and Shepard agreed to reopen the case. One of the first things they did was re-interview everyone in the case. One person they could not interview was the original suspect in the case, Malin's boyfriend. He had died 2 years earlier. The detectives interviewed Malin's daughter, Susan, who had changed her surname to Watson. She was 41 years old and lived in Schenectady, New York. She was married and had three daughters. She worked as a keyboard operator. When they interviewed Susan, Detective Saber noticed something was off about her body language. There was also some problems with her answers. For example, she was fully dressed when the police arrived. She had no explanation as to why she was dressed instead of wearing her PJs. Also, her brother said that he found blood in the sink. If Malin's boyfriend shot her and then ran away, how did the blood get in the sink? It would have been unusual for him to shoot her, wash his hands, then run out of the apartment and speed away. The detectives reviewed Susan's initial interview with the police in 1971. Saber thought it was odd because Susan didn't seem to answer the questions directly. Her mother had been murdered. Why wasn't she being as helpful as possible? A major problem for the detectives was the time of death. The pathologist believed Malin had been killed 2 hours before the police were called. Why would Susan have waited so long to call 911? Saber came up with a plausible explanation. He said Susan, quote, waited 2 hours to get her story together because she killed her mom. She panicked. She sat there and said, what lie can I tell so they won't focus in on me? Unquote. The detectives decided to interview Susan again at the police station. On October 23, 1998, they talked to her for 2 hours in a friendly manner. Susan said that she felt she could trust them. She then admitted to killing her mother. She was 14 years old, and her mother's boyfriend had been sexually abusing her. She said she told her mother, but her mother didn't do anything about it. She also claimed her mother was mentally and physically abusive. So she got the gun out of the drawer. She shot her mother in the chest while she was asleep. Madeline sat up and said Susan, and then fell back into the bed. Susan said that after shooting her 30-year-old mother, she hid behind a curtain. She wiped her fingerprints off the gun and returned it to the drawer. After confessing, Susan was arrested and charged with murder. It was not a case that experts in the law didn't know how to prosecute. According to the Associated Press, it was one of the first times in the United States an adult was facing charges for a crime they committed as a minor. Susan was 14 when she committed the murder, so she was placed in juvenile detention center for the first few days. Then she was transferred to an adult facility. The law in 1971 stated that anyone under the age of 16 could not be tried as an adult. The maximum punishment for a juvenile in 1971 was that they would be incarcerated until age 21. But the laws had changed since then, and a 14-year-old who committed a murder could be sentenced up to 20 years of prison. So should Susan be tried as an adult for a crime she committed when she was a minor? Should the current juvenile laws be applied to her and she be sentenced to 20 years of prison? In the United States, most, if not all, people convicted in cold cases are sentenced based on sentencing guidelines at the time of their offense. For example, if someone committed a murder when there was no death penalty, and they get arrested after the state makes capital punishment legal, they would not be eligible to receive the death penalty. But if they use sentencing guidelines from 1971, then Susan couldn't be punished because it was impossible to hold her until she was 21 because she was 41 years old. Robert Swartz, director of the Juvenile Law Center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, said, quote, "The laws aren't written for this kind of case," unquote. The prosecution said that just because time had passed and Susan went undetected during that time, it shouldn't exclude her from prosecution. After all, she did murder her mother, and there should be legal repercussions for that. She stole away her brother's mother, who were just 8 and 10 when Malin was killed. But like everyone else in the case, the prosecution didn't know what type of sentence she should receive. In the end, Susan Watson did not go to trial. 5 months after she confessed, in April 1999, Family Court Judge Michael Dennen dismissed the charges against her. Dennen said that the most important factor when sentencing juveniles is to rehabilitate and not punish. In the 27 years since the murder, Susan had not committed any other crimes. She was also a responsible member of society. She was a wife and mother, had a full-time job, and performed public services. She also was not a danger to society. So she was free to leave the courtroom. Both of Susan's brothers, David and George, attended the hearing. After the charges were dismissed, she hugged both of them. However, George did not return her embrace. He was unhappy with the judge's decision. He said, quote, "She should have been punished. I suffered for 27 years, unquote. No record of what happened to Susan Watson after the charges were dismissed can be found. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Like we said in the opening, if you have any cases to suggest for Into the Killing, Criminally Listed, or Paranormally Listed, please visit our website, criminallylisted.com. Well, that's all for this week. Thank you again for listening. Please stay safe and take care of yourself.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.